Holy God, oil the hinges of our hearts' doors, that they may swing gently and easily to welcome your coming. Amen. When you are first introduced to him, what you notice is the sound of children's laughter filling his house and spilling out into the yard. You cannot help but observe that his magnificent home is bright and cheerful and comfortable, his table laden with good foods and fine wines. His lands and pastures are teeming with fat cattle. When you are first introduced to Job, you cannot help but like him. He knows himself to be blessed. He has everything. He has riches and property, family and friends, health and happiness. And he takes none of it for granted. And then, out of nowhere, with a terrible and abrupt ferocity, these are taken from him: his possessions, his health, his children, his joy. Job is undone, his grief beyond words, his agony overwhelming. He aches for nothing so much as to die. He wants to be put out of his misery. He has seen too much of life and wishes now only to be enveloped in blackness, in the blackness of a tomb. Job's friends arrive. Ostensibly, they have come to keep vigil with their grieving brother. Instead, however, they begin to opine, to discuss, to analyze, to theorize, to philosophize, to conjecture, to posit. They arrive at the opinion that Job surely must have done something to deserve this. His friends contend that such misfortune simply doesn't come from nowhere. It has an origin, that this calamity is earned. This is no fluke, they say. This is payback, they say, for something. They don't know what, but something. It must be. That, they say, is how this universe works. That, they say, is how God works. You do something wrong, you get clobbered. You sin, God smacks you. Job protests. He maintains he has not sinned. He's done nothing wrong. In the world of reward and punishment, he insists, something is woefully out of whack. Something has gone terribly awry. He doesn't know what, but something's wrong. And what Job wants, what Job needs, is for his friends to shut up. Shut up! And what he needs is for God to show up. He needs to speak with God, to make his case before God. He longs to plead his cause. He wants to grab hold of God's lapels and look him in the eyes and explain that something is not right. This calamity that has befallen him is ill-directed. There's been a terrible mistake, God. And yet for days, Job's friends are there, and they theorize, and they conjecture, and they posit, and they philosophize, and they opine about sin and justice and guilt and consequence. And for days, Job listens to this, and he grieves and he protests, shaking his fists at heaven, all the while wishing he were dead. And then God shows up. God climbs down out of the divine throne. God descends from on high, arriving at Job's side in a whirlwind, a storm. And it is out of this whirlwind that the divine voice speaks. "Gird up your loins, Job. Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me." Odd, isn't it? This is God's response to Job's distress, a debate, a Q&A, "Gird up your loins." Job girds his loins. He arranges his robe, tightens his belt, rolls up his sleeves, gathers his thoughts, readies himself for God's questions. "Where were you, Job, when I laid the foundation of the earth?" asks God. Job stutters and fumbles for words. Nothing comes. The question is unanswerable. Job is speechless. He is silent. There is no contest here, no debate at all. God continues, "Who determined the earth's measurements, Job? Or on what were its bases sunk, Job? Who laid its cornerstone, Job? Where were you when the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly hosts shouted for joy? Can you make it rain, Job? Can you make the lightning, Job? Can you number the clouds, Job? Can you hunt prey for the lion, Job? Who provides for the raven its prey, Job?" Silence. There's no contest, no debate at all. What the hell is going on here? Job is suffering. He is in profound distress. He is in pain, and God is stargazing. Job is undone, while God is admiring flashes of lightning. Job is in anguish while God is procuring a mouse to feed a raven, a hyena to feed a lion. And that's not all. That's just the beginning. It goes on and on and on. The reader is treated to page after page after page of God's keen interest in the intricate and strange marvels of creation, in ostriches, snorting horses, and soaring eagles. What is going on here? Job, who has seen too much of life already, so much so that he wants nothing more than to close his eyes and be enveloped in darkness, in the blackness of a tomb, Job is treated instead to a panoramic view of the splendor of all creation, to dancing stars and a translucent moon, to shimmering oceans, purple wildflowers, ponderous hippopotami. In fact, Job is treated to a personal tour of the creation by creation's artist. God, Job learns, loves all of creation, all of it together, the way the mighty horse snorts and the eagle's keen eye and the white and pink hues of the lotus flower, and the ostrich's glossy, cream-colored egg, and the heft of the hippopotamus. And not only those bits of creation, in this cascade of images, this vision of creation's intricacies and delicacies, creation's weirdness and strangeness, vastness and wildness, Job's eyes begin to be opened and he begins to see into the divine heart. And what he sees is this, that among this cascade of images of creation's grand, expansive, majestic sweep, there's this truth that it is for one small, finite, anguished creature. It is for one creature who has cried to the heavens, who has shaken his fist, who has grasped hold of the divine lapels. It is for this one small, grieving man, and for he alone that the heavens have opened and before whom God has troubled to appear, and to whom alone among all creation God deigns to speak. We are the ones with whom God converses. We are the ones to whom God reveals God's heart. Now, Job's suffering is not abated with this. It will have been by the end of the book, but it's not abated yet. He is nevertheless comforted by God's attention. He is moved. He is profoundly moved that the Holy One, elusive and inscrutable, has come down, has pulled back a corner of the curtain and revealed to Job a piece of the divine heart. "Ah," says Job, "now my eyes see thee." "Ah," says Job, "now my eyes see thee." There is a postscript to the book of Job. And in that postscript, those things that Job loves most are returned to him. Once again, the sound of children's laughter fills his house. His home is again cheerful and bright, and his pasture lands teeming with fat cattle. In the end, in the postscript, Job's suffering is relieved. I suppose the biblical writers could not bear to leave it otherwise. And I suppose this as well. They could not bear to leave it otherwise because they too were given a peek behind the curtain. They too saw what Job saw. They too were treated to a vision of the divine heart. Amen.